Imagine walking into a corporate boardroom. It's packed with heavily armed executives who are, actively hostile and want you permanently removed from the picture.
Right. Definitely not a great situation to walk into.
Not at all. And instead of fighting your way out or, like, begging for your job, you confidently stroll to the head of the table. You act deeply offended by the room's decor and then casually fire the CEO.
Oh, wow. The sheer unapologetic audacity required to pull something like that off is just staggering.
It really is. But what if I told you that exact kind of asymmetric psychological warfare is sometimes the only way to survive an impossible situation? Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we have a truly fascinating set of sources for you.
Yeah, we are unpacking a highly detailed narrative log tracking a group of adventurers, and they are navigating this incredibly perilous, trap-filled environment known as the Ice Jaw Pit.
Right, and their ultimate goal here is to breach a stronghold called the Destroyer's Keep.
Which is just as ominous as it sounds. But these logs provide so much more than just a summary of a fantasy journey. What we are looking at is a dense, high-stakes masterclass in problem-solving under extreme duress.
Yeah, exactly.
It explores complex group dynamics, the mechanics of asymmetric warfare, and the intense psychological weight of leadership, especially when every single decision carries a lethal consequence.
Absolutely. And to understand how they even stand a chance, you really need to know who is in the room. Or, well, in this case, who is descending into this freezing abyss. First, there's Thomas, the Lord Explorer.
Right, he's the tactical center of the group, highly observant, but, carrying a very heavy burden.
Exactly. Then we have Redmayne, who is sometimes referred to as Agatha. She's the Lady Knight, just fiercely brave, a frontline combatant who completely thrives in chaos.
She really does. And then you've got Sir Llewellyn, a young, eager knight whose bravery sometimes outpaces his actual experience.
Yeah, definitely. And there's Rachel, the Golden Hawk translator. She is incredibly crucial to the mission, yet she spends most of this journey feeling entirely out of her depth.
Which is so relatable, honestly.
Yeah.
And finally, there's Ahern, who isn't just a mount, he is the highly intelligent Lord of Horses.
I love Ahern, but this composition, this specific cast, is the key to their survival. We often talk about intelligence as a monolith, right?
Oh, yeah, completely. But this narrative beautifully illustrates how surviving a completely unpredictable, hostile environment requires totally different, overlapping types of intelligence.
Tactical, emotional, all of it.
Exactly. I mean, tactical intelligence is required to win a sword fight, sure. But emotional and psychological intelligence are required to navigate the crushing pressure of the environment itself. If they all thought like Thomas or, all thought like Redmayne, they wouldn't last a single day.
Okay, let's unpack this by looking at their arrival at a place, ominously, but I guess accurately, named the Point of Peril.
Very accurate.
Yeah, it's situated right before the Bridge of Sorrows, and the environmental conditions here are absolutely miserable. We're talking freezing rain, peppercorn-sized hail, basically zero visibility.
It's just a nightmare scenario.
Right. And Thomas makes a leadership call. He decides he needs to personally check the massive stone supports of the bridge for sabotage before the rest of the group crosses. So he ties a rope around himself and rappels down into the icy, blinding abyss.
Which, it is a calculated risk born from necessity. He needs data on the structural integrity of their path. But the defining characteristic of the ice jaw pit is that the environment actively punishes routine data gathering.
That is putting it mildly.
Right.
While he is hanging over the void, literally blinded by sleet, he realizes he's not alone on the underside of that bridge.
Oh, this card is terrifying.
Right. Clinging to the stone is a black wyvern, a massive, leathery, dragon-like apex predator, and it lunges at him. Its talons literally crunch into the stone masonry inches from his head.
Notice the cascade effect here. The moment the wyvern attacks, the group's dynamic is instantly forced into activation. But they are operating from a massive physical disadvantage.
Thomas is dangling there like bait on a fishing line. Sir Llewellyn and Rachel frantically grab the rope to haul him up, but the ice is too slick.
They can't get any traction.
No, Llewellyn actually loses his grip.
Oh.
So Rachel realizes raw human strength is just going to fail, and she improvises. She hooks the rope to the pommel of her horse, true, using the animal's massive counterweight to drag Thomas over the ledge.
Which is brilliant. Meanwhile, down below, Redmayne and her magical steed, Ahern, intentionally make themselves giant targets. They're trying to draw the wyvern's fire away from the rope.
Right, but the environment escalates the punishment. Just as the wyvern swoops in to attack Radmain, breathing literal streams of fire, a swarm of giant spiders begins pouring out of the freezing woods behind them.
Drawn by all the commotion, yeah.
It's the ultimate cascading system's failure. It's like pulling a single corrupted line of code to fix a minor bug in a routine software update. And suddenly the entire global payment gateway crashes, which then triggers a massive unrelated cybersecurity breach in your mainframe.
That is a perfect analogy.
A routine safety check turned into a multi-front war in a matter of seconds. But Redmain manages to strike the Wyvern's heart with her lance.
Yeah, but the momentum leaves her trapped, right?
Exactly. She's stuck between a falling, dying wyvern and an incoming wave of giant spiders. And that's when Ahern, the Lord of Horses, executes this physically impossible maneuver.
Oh, I love this visual.
He drives his hooves deep into the slick ice, sending up actual sparks, and lunges forcefully backwards to avoid the spiders. This allows them to swarm the wyvern's corpse instead of Redmain.
The sheer physics of that evasion are impressive. What's fascinating here is the psychological state of the team.
Right, the mindset.
Exactly. There is an absolute absence of panic. When the situation devolves from a scouting mission into a chaotic two-front battle, no one freezes. More importantly, no one tries to do someone else's job.
That's a great point.
Thomas evades, Rachel improvises the hauling mechanism, Redmain runs interference, and Ahern handles the tactical mobility. In crisis management, and for you listening, think about the teams you operate within. Knowing your specific role in a sudden crisis is infinitely more valuable than knowing the entire grand plan.
They survived that bridge because they trusted each other to handle their respective zones of genius without micromanaging.
Spot on.
So they barely survive, but they managed to push forward into the ice jaw pit and set up a temporary camp. And this is a brilliant narrative shift. The physical adrenaline fades, and the psychological toll of the environment immediately rushes in to fill the vacuum.
It always does.
Yeah. Thomas pulls out this cursed item they recovered earlier. It's a dark book belonging to a water mage named Faust.
And the mechanics of Faust's magic are so insidious. Thomas realizes the book is essentially a psychological trap. It doesn't contain fixed text. It actively scans the reader's mind and shapes its contents to present a roadmap to their deepest, most unvocalized desires.
It's wild. When Thomas reads it, the book promises him ultimate fame. It outlines exactly how he can become the greatest, most renowned explorer in history.
It completely weaponizes his own ambition against him.
Yes. But when he hands the book to Redmain to test its effects on someone else, she feels absolutely nothing. She just looks at the pages and sees harmless gibberish.
Because it only has power over those with massive world-altering ambitions.
Right. Thomas recognizes the danger and forces himself to put it away. But while he's quietly grappling with the allure of that vanity, we get this incredibly revealing, quiet moment on the night watch between Redmain and Rachel.
Yeah, the password scene.
We use passwords to identify each other in the dark Jack of Hearts and the Year's End. And Rachel, the translator, just breaks down.
She confesses to a crushing case of imposter syndrome.
Exactly. She tells Redmain she feels completely useless. She points out that she's not a warrior, she possesses no magic, and she even misses her targets with her crossbow. She articulates this deep fear that history will only remember her as the foolish damsel who constantly needed to be rescued by the heroes.
Redmain's response is a masterclass in reframing value. She points out a crucial detail from the bridge encounter. When the giant spiders swarmed out of the woods, Rachel didn't freeze in awe or try to fight a battle she couldn't win.
Right, she didn't try to be a knight.
Exactly. She ran to secure the horses and the escape route. Redmain looks at her and says, "You really are the sanest one among us."
Okay, wait, I have to push back on that logic. If you are marching into a fortress, literally called the Destroyer's Keep, isn't a team of fearless, physically unstoppable, ambitious warriors exactly what you want? Why would Rachel's fear, or her sanity, as Redmain calls it, be considered a strategic asset?
Because fearlessness without a tether is just a countdown to a fatal mistake. If everyone on the team is a risk-taking hero looking for glory, the team dies.
I see.
Thomas and Redmain possess incredible bravery, but that bravery naturally creates a blind spot to mundane dangers. Rachel's imposter syndrome is actually a highly functional, rational respect for mortality. She is their anchor to reality.
And they desperately need that anchor, don't they?
They really do. Because, as the logs reveal in this exact conversation, their physical reality is actively being overwritten by the realm itself.
The lore drop during this campfire scene completely recontextualizes the entire journey. Rachel points out that Thomas and Redmayne are physically transforming. They're growing taller, their posture is shifting. Redmayne has actually lost her freckles.
We have to explain the mechanics of this universe to fully grasp the horror of what's happening to them here. The sources explicitly detail their mortal origins. These characters are originally from our world, specifically a place called Annington, around the years 1912 and 1913.
Right, early 20th century Earth.
Yes, they have connections to a mortal figure named Ryan Jordan, and somehow they were pulled from 1912 Earth into this magical fey realm called Mirari.
So they aren't just fantasy characters, they're people from 1912 thrust into a nightmare.
Precisely, and the environment of Mirari is fundamentally incompatible with mortal physiology. The realm feeds on intent and magic. The longer they stay in the ice shop pit, the more the environment physically strips away their soft, mortal, childlike features.
It's forcing them to adapt.
It is aggressively forcing their DNA to adapt into these ancient, powerful, fey-like forms so they can survive. But the terrifying cost of that physical upgrade is their humanity. If they adapt completely, they forget who they were.
Which leads to Thomas voicing a horrifying theory. They are hunting an ancient, immortal evil known as the Destroyer. But Thomas realizes that if Mirari corrupts mortals into ancient beings, what if the Destroyer isn't an ancient god at all?
Oh, this gives me chills.
What if it's actually John Harcourt, an old mortal acquaintance from 1912 who got trapped here long ago and fully succumbed to the realm's corruption?
It changes the stakes entirely. They aren't just fighting monsters. They are fighting the environment's attempt to overwrite their identities. That is why Rachel's mortal anxiety is their most valuable asset. Her fear proves she is still human.
That constant pressure to adapt physically and psychologically brings us to how they handle the actual mechanical obstacles deeper in the pit. Because adaptation isn't just about identity, right? It's highly tactical.
Absolutely.
They are moving through a corridor and hear two goblins, gnats and fleas, resetting a massive trap ahead. Normally, a stealthy group would try to tiptoe past the pressure plate. Instead, Thomas picks up a heavy rock and intentionally hurls it directly onto the trigger mechanism.
He deliberately springs a trap on himself.
Yes. A massive stone wall crashes down from the ceiling, blocking the corridor, and Thomas just calmly explains to the group that he would rather trigger it right now, on his own terms, and see exactly what it does, rather than constantly worry about it and accidentally trip it later when they are running for their lives.
It is a brilliant example of stealing the environmental advantage. By triggering the trap intentionally, he removes the enemy's leverage. The trap goes from being a deadly surprise to a known variable that Thomas now controls.
And it sets up the most audacious tactical pivot of the entire journey. They know the noise of the crashing wall will draw the goblins out to investigate, so they set an ambush.
This part is so clever.
They use a magical glamour to disguise the majestic Ahern, making him look like a dusty, ordinary pack horse wandering aimlessly. The goblins come out, think they've just scored a free piece of livestock, and the team instantly drops out of the shadows and subdues them.
But the interrogation of gnats and fleas reveals a catastrophic intelligence failure. There isn't just a handful of goblins operating a few traps. The captured goblins reveal there was an entire village of over 100 armed goblins stationed in the cavern ahead, blocking the only secret tunnels that lead to the keep.
100 to 5 are impossible odds. Fighting is guaranteed suicide. Sneaking is impossible. So Thomas decides to weaponize the goblin's own command structure.
Here we go.
He uses his glamour magic again, but this time on himself. He alters his appearance to look terrifying, towering, and cloaked in dark, imposing energy. He then marches the two captured goblins right into the center of this massive cavern.
Just unbelievable.
Over 100 armed goblins turn to look at him. He is flanked by their chieftain, who is wearing a massive bull skull headdress. And Thomas just bluffs. He acts deeply offended by the state of their camp and loudly claims he is the Great Lord, which is their reverent title for the Destroyer.
The sheer psychological weight of this gambit cannot be overstated. He is walking into the lion's den wearing a meat suit, demanding the lions apologize to him.
Here's where it gets really interesting, and this goes back to the boardroom analogy I mentioned at the start. It's like a low-level employee putting on a tailored suit, walking straight into a hostile corporate boardroom and confidently demanding a status report from the CEO.
It's exactly like that.
Thomas yells at the chieftain, claiming he is there to conduct a surprise inspection of the defenses. When the chieftain, who is slightly suspicious, asks about the massive hoard of gold they were promised for guarding the tunnels, Rachel steps in.
She translates the goblin tongue, right?
Yeah, and she brilliantly covers for Thomas's lack of knowledge. Thomas catches on and imperiously promises they will receive their full reward only after Mirari falls. He demands they clear the path immediately.
This is textbook asymmetric warfare. Mm-hmm. Thomas realized he couldn't win a battle of force. But he also recognized that the goblins operated on a rigid hierarchy of fear. The chieftain ruled by being the scariest thing in the room.
Right, it's all about projecting power.
Exactly. By projecting an aura of unquestionable authority and acting like he owned the place, Thomas completely bypassed the physical rules of the obstacle. He co-opted their bureaucracy. For anyone listening, how often do you face an insurmountable organizational obstacle where the rules can simply be bypassed if you act with absolute, unquestionable confidence?
The goblins are so terrified by the audacity of his demands that their hierarchical programming just takes over. They literally clear the path and let the team walk right through.
That's incredible.
But Thomas's bluff worked because the goblins rely on a chain of command. How do you negotiate when hierarchy means absolutely nothing? That's the exact problem they hit next. They bypass an illusory rock wall at this aid. Thomas dispels it by playing a highly specific tune on a silver flute decorated with a rose, and they step into a vast, hidden cavern.
And what a cavern it is.
Sunlight is spilling in from a ventilation shaft above, illuminating mountains of gold, jewels, and glowing magical swords. And resting comfortably on top of it all is Monitor, a giant black iron dragon with razor-sharp metal spines that sway with every breath he takes.
Monitor's fully awake, and he immediately calls out their deception. He reveals that the actual destroyer paid him a massive hoard of gold specifically to guard this back entrance against intruders.
I genuinely struggle to understand the mechanics of this next sequence. You have an ancient iron dragon. It sleeps on a literal mountain of gold. It can vaporize you with a single breath. What possible leverage do you have in that negotiation?
Not much, on paper.
Right. The dragon demands a unique toll from each member of the party to turn a blind eye and let them pass. They obviously can't offer him money, so what do they pay with? The sequence of payments is mesmerizing. Redmayne steps up first.
Oh, this is so good.
She removes her metal gauntlets, walks right up to the dragon's massive, terrifying face, and boldly kisses his scorching iron cheek.
This raises an important question. You had to completely redefine leverage here. Why does a kiss work as currency for an iron dragon?
Right. Why does he care?
Because when you are dealing with an entity that possesses infinite material resources, gold is useless. The actual currency of the omnipotent is novelty. Redmayne offered him audacity. She gave an immortal creature an experience he has likely never had in his centuries of existence, someone approaching him without terror.
That makes perfect sense. Then Thomas steps up. He doesn't offer gold either. He reaches into his pack and offers the dangerous, desire-reading Dark Book of Faust that they found earlier.
Thomas pays with dangerous knowledge. Again, this is a highly prized commodity for a creature that spends its life hoarding secrets and leverage.
Then Rachel, who earlier was terrified of her own shadow, bravely walks right up to the dragon's massive head and simply whispers a secret into his ear. We, the audience, don't even know what she said. But Monitor loves it.
She pays with mystery. She leverages her own hidden depths, proving that even the most ordinary mortal carries information an immortal dragon finds fascinating.
And finally, Sir Lefelon and the Horse Ahern have absolutely nothing left to give, so Monitor offers them a deal, an IOU. If they promise to retrieve a specific, highly dangerous, ancient artifact of power from inside the destroyer's keep and bring it back to him later, he'll consider their toll paid.
That's quite a promise.
They agree, and the dragon lets them pass.
Lefelon and Ahern pay with future utility. This entire scene is a masterclass in high-stakes negotiation. When you find yourself in a room where you have no traditional leverage, no money, no title, no power, you have to discover your counterpart's actual currency. For Monitor, the currencies were audacity, knowledge, mystery, and future favors.
But the high of surviving a negotiation with a dragon evaporates almost instantly. Right before they leave the cavern, Thomas asks Monitor a deeply personal question. He asks if the dragon has seen an old friend named Randall.
The tone shift here is jarring.
The logs explain that Randall was a mortal who took Thomas's place in the town guard back in their world. Randall died protecting others, and rumor had it the destroyer resurrected him as a corrupted wraith. Monitor just vaguely points them toward the exit.
Yeah, the narrative tone shifts violently here. The whimsy of outsmarting goblins and bargaining with dragons is entirely stripped away.
They begin to climb this massive cylindrical stone stairwell leading up into the keep. As they ascend in the dark, they start finding grim markers. Broken bones, ragged clothes, heavy monster tracks. And then, descending from the darkness completely soundlessly, is a wraith.
The anticipation is agonizing.
It is clad in black leather and silver chainmail. It's Randall, the corrupted, undead shell of Thomas's best friend.
Up until this exact moment on the stairs, the group has survived by perfectly integrating their diverse skills. Redmayne's combat, Rachel's translations, Thomas's bluffs, Ahern's mobility, they have functioned as a single, highly efficient organism.
But here, Tomnacht issues a final, heartbreaking command. He tells the entire group to stand back and not interfere. He draws his silver sword, offers a solemn, respectful salute to the monster wearing his best friend's face, and quietly says, "Let it begin." He chooses to face him in a brutal one-on-one duel to give Randall's soul the rest it deserves.
And that perfectly encapsulates the absolute isolating burden of leadership. It is the tragic counterweight to everything we've analyzed today. Yes, some battles can be delegated to your team's specific zones of genius. Some systemic obstacles can be bypassed with brilliant bureaucratic trickery, and some overwhelming opponents can be negotiated with if you find their true currency. But eventually, there are some ghosts, some direct consequences of your own past choices that you have to step up and face completely alone. No one else can swing the sword for him here.
So what does this all mean? We followed this incredible journey from the freezing sleet of the Boot of Sorrows down into the depths of the Dragon's Lair. It shows us that survival isn't a single treat.
Far from it.
It requires physical bravery, certainly, but it also requires the psychological resilience to confront your own imposter syndrome and the physical morphing of your reality. It requires the absolute audacity to bluff an entire hostile organization and the deep wisdom to understand what an invincible opponent truly values at a negotiation table.
I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over, building on the mechanics of that dragon negotiation. We focused heavily on the brilliance of Redmayne's audacity and Thomas's offering of knowledge. But think about Sir Lefalon and Ahern.
The IOU.
Exactly. They paid their toll with an IOU. They promised to deliver a dangerous artifact in the future just to survive the present. Look at your own life, your career, or your relationships. What dragon have you promised to pay later?
Oh, that's heavy.
When we defer a crisis by handing out an IOU, whether it's putting off a difficult conversation, ignoring a structural flaw in a project, or compromising a core value just to get through the day we are mortgaging our future to survive today, what is the compounding interest on that psychological debt, and what happens when the dragon finally comes to collect?
That is a deeply unsettling but necessary question to end on. Taking control of the chaos requires understanding the true cost of your survival. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the Icejaw Pit. We hope you walk away feeling a little more prepared to navigate the wyverns, the goblins, and the boardroom dragons in your own life. Until next time, keep exploring.